It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, writer Anne Lamott's latest book asks how we can find courage and happiness when things seem hopeless. We'll listen back to our conversation with her about how to make it through tough times. First, 49% of the U.S. population is fully vaccinated against COVID-19, but the rate of new vaccinations is slowing and cases are rising as the more contagious Delta variant spreads. The Surgeon General's office says that's due in part to misinformation about the virus and the vaccines. An advisory released last week called misinformation an urgent public health threat. Surgeon General Dr. Vivek Murthy said social media platforms are partly responsible for a lot of that misleading info and should take more action against users who spread it.
Now, health misinformation didn't start with COVID-19. What's different now, though, is the speed and scale at which health misinformation is spreading. Modern technology companies have enabled misinformation to poison our information environment with little accountability to their users.
President Biden and Dr. Anthony Fauci both echoed those comments over the weekend, but Facebook says the White House is looking for scapegoats after they say praising the company's efforts behind closed doors. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think that social media platforms should do more to take down inaccurate or misleading posts about COVID-19 and vaccines, or at least to make them be served up less to users? Do you think it's right for the government to put pressure on companies to do something like that? Have you noticed misinformation about COVID-19 maybe driving the health decisions of people close to you? Have you ever felt unsure about what sources to trust when you're online yourself? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Vish Vishwanath is a professor of health communication in the Department of Social and Behavioral Sciences at Harvard University's T.H. Chan School of Public Health. He's founding director of the Enhancing Communications for Health Outcomes Laboratory at the Dana-Farber Harvard Cancer Center. Vish, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me, Rob.
Well, we heard there the Surgeon General, Vish, saying, yeah, we've had misinformation about health before, but it's something's different now with the technology, with the social media platforms that allows it to really mushroom and spread. Do you think there's something to that?
Absolutely. I think, you know, misinformation is very, you know, as old as information or rumors. And in fact, you know, we used to talk about snake oil salesmen, you know, so a long time ago. So it's nothing new. There have always been, misstatement of facts and a misunderstanding of factual information, but also spreading, folklore as facts and science. So that is itself, by itself, is not new, but it is absolutely correct that the Surgeon General said, the scale and the speed, you know, what we call as velocity, with which it is spreading, and it has spread, is unusual, I think. We have not seen anything like this before.
Now, part of this is that once we are interested in something, social media and other platforms can funnel it to us. If I watch a certain kind of music video on YouTube, it's going to suggest more of that kind of music to me. If somebody looks at some misinformation about, say, COVID-19, the algorithm is going to keep serving up more stuff like that. Is this just a kind of a runaway train once people start down this path?
So some people have actually characterized it as such, you know. So once you go into something, it's a rabbit hole, and then it feeds you more of what you are looking for. There is certainly a lot of truth to that. I think, you know, sometimes some have said even the social media don't understand the algorithms that they have spawned, you know. So I think that amplifies and reinforces what you are interested in, and if you are interested in conspiracy theories, and that's you are much more likely to be fed conspiracy theories. But there is another element that is often forgotten in this discussion, which is it can be even more potent from a misinformation point of view when offline and online sources work together. What I mean by that is if somebody from offline picks it up, say a very prominent personality, a politician or a celebrity, and says something about it that is also picked up by other media. And that's what, you know, when the Surgeon General said it's an ecosystem, that's what happens. You know, somebody can pick it up from online and then amplify it. And then it becomes kind of a spiral of amplification, polluting the entire environment, information environment.
Now, here are with the president, other members of the White House, the Surgeon General saying, hey, Facebook and other social media platforms, we'd like to see you do something to take the most egregious offenders and mute their messages, at least some. And other people looking at that kind of uncomfortably saying, wait, do we want our leaders putting pressure to limit communication on different elements of media? What do you think of that that debate and that call from the White House?
So it's a difficult dilemma, Rob. If you think about it, you know, what can we do about it, right? I mean, that's the question. We all recognize, even the social media platforms themselves recognize that there is a tremendous amount of misinformation out there, that they have contributed to it. And in fact, some of them are doing a lot to check it as much as possible. So they recognize it. The political system and policy makers recognize it. Some of us who are working on this in research recognize it. But something has to be done. And this is where I think, you know, a honest, open debate is essential. Now, those of us who have been trained in appreciating and freedom of expression and having government does not having, you know, with a desire that government does not interfere with free expression, are certainly uncomfortable with it. And we don't want the government to come in and tell us, you know, or tell anybody, you know, what to do or how to think and how to express themselves, especially in our country where we value this kind of autonomy and freedom. At the same time, we are in a very different situation here. And the social media have to come forward and take responsibility for it. And given their reluctance, in addressing this, and, you know, these questions come up, I think. So my position is certainly there is certain amount of discomfort in doing this, mm-hmm. but at the same time, social media have to acknowledge and do much more than they're doing in addressing the misinformation.
Vish Viswanath is with us from Harvard's School of Public Health. We're talking about misinformation about COVID-19 and vaccines, why it spreads so quickly, what, if anything, could be done about it. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think that social media platforms should block people who share a lot of mis or disinformation about COVID, or at least throttle down on how quickly those messages get shared? Do you see a lot of bad info out there, or has it affected someone maybe close to you? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Vish, let's flip things around. Instead of looking at how to stop the bad info, how about how to spread the right info? It seems like we got a pretty simple message here. Vaccines seem to be working really well. People who are not vaccinated are disproportionately represented in new cases and new hospitalizations for COVID. How do we get the good message through and out there and competing successfully with the bad stuff?
Sure. So this is not rocket science, as they say. You know, we know this. We have done this before in the form of health campaigns, and we can do it again. We know that people rely on certain credible sources for information. Not everybody is on social media. Not everybody is relying on social media for their information. There are many people in the, especially the people we work with, you know, racial and ethnic minorities, those we classically call as underserved people from a lower socioeconomic position. A lot of them rely on community leaders within their communities, my pastor, my church leader, elder, or my, you know, my priest, or the community-based organizations that I go to for my help. Within my communities, those leaders are highly trusted, and it's a really good idea to invest in them in providing that information. We also know that despite the popular impression, scientists and physicians continue to be held high in high regard by people. You know, people generally go to their physician. You know, the physician is a first stop at their office. Equipping the physicians and the physician offices and healthcare providers is another way to do this. So there are ways to do this very successfully, and we have done it before by identifying who are these credible sources that people rely on, and how can we equip these trusted local leaders and provide them with this information is something we can do.
Now, I know political divides over vaccination efforts go back even before we had vaccination. The earliest smallpox inoculations in the United States to be, there was a political split over them. But it seems like, I don't know, Vish, the partisan divide over this and the way it breaks down over vaccination seems really big. I don't know about unprecedented, but big. How do we overcome that?
So here are some data. Fundamentally, I agree with you. I don't think I have seen this kind of a partisan split before. You know, we have always had vaccination contested. We have always had, especially in times of infections, ideas contested, right? You can even talk about HIV and AIDS. You know, there have been people who questioned whether AIDS is caused by HIV. So that itself is not unusual. But what is unusual in this sense is there's a clear partisan identification with one position or other. Our own data have shown it. Other surveys by Pew Research Centers and others have clearly shown that if you identify with one particular political party, you are much less likely to get vaccinated compared to other political parties. And here, having said that, if you look at the data, what we are finding is it still remains that 65 to 70 to 75% of the people will get vaccination at some point or other. And most of, we are getting closer slowly but steadily. Now, another 15%, and the numbers may vary from survey to survey, another 10-15% may say that they will get it only if they are required to do so. So it's just another 10%, I would say, you know, who say that they will never get the vaccination, you know. So what we need to do is we really need to find this group of people who are in this so-called watchful waiting. Either I will wait it out or I will get it only if it's required, and work with that group. Find out who their leaders are, who they can trust, and make sure that we communicate with them and get them the messages. I think that is the challenge. That's a real challenge, especially when it's being debated, even within the Republican Party. For example, there are leaders who are saying go get vaccinated, but there are also leaders who are saying no, and that's going to be continue to be a problem, as we are seeing it now with the spikes in selected parts of the country.
We're talking to Vish Viswanath, professor of health communication at the Harvard School of Public Health, looking at COVID-19 misinformation online and offline. The Surgeon General's office is calling this an urgent public health threat of misinformation. You can join in with your thoughts, your questions. Best way to reach us right now appears to be email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. Phone lines are blipping a little bit. You can still try at 800-642-1234. Knock on wood and cross your fingers. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk now with Vish Viswanath, professor of health communication at the Harvard School of Public Health. We're looking at the COVID-19 misinformation that's out there online, in particular after the U.S. Surgeon General said social media platforms should do more to find it and take it down. You could email your thoughts, ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org, or tweet us at Central Time WPR. Phone lines still pending. Sorry if you've tried to call and found nothing waiting for you. But the number when it comes back is 800-642-1234. Again, email ideas@WPR.org. Vish, one challenge all along with COVID-19 was that this was a new virus for us humans, and we were trying to figure it out as we went, and our understanding of it changed over time. What are some of the key elements for health communication when you've got this moving target where science is trying to keep up with it?
I think if nothing else, this is one of the biggest challenges we are facing, right? So if you go back 16 months ago in January of 2020, when we were just hearing about this, about some virus, some things happening in China. In fact, I was in India in January being interviewed by a reporter, and you know, we didn't know anything, you know, at the time. And as we, you know, 16 months later, here we are trying to figure out, and we still don't know much, right? You know, we know a lot, but we also don't know a lot as we are seeing. So when people, you know, are hearing these messages and information on it, they are looking for certainty. And they are looking to scientists, they are looking to political leaders, they are looking to the healthcare system and saying that give us some information that is in black and white. But the science is changing. So the nature of facts change, and therefore the recommendations are changing, right? You know, first we said don't wear face masks, you know, leave them for healthcare providers. And now then we said, well, go ahead and get face masks because everybody needs it. So I think people are frustrated. People always wonder why the scientists can't make up their mind and give, you know, stick to one set of recommendations. Rob, this happens in every subject. You know, if you take heart disease, about cholesterol, about eggs, if you recall, you know, but those recommendations change over a period of time. But we have never seen anything like this in such a compressed period of time. So, excuse me. So thanks to our investment in scientific enterprise, we learned a tremendous amount of information. But we learned all of it in a very short period of 16 months. And that has made it very difficult, I think, because as the knowledge changed, our recommendations changed. And because they change in such a fast-paced way, in such a short time, people are frustrated about it. The second thing one should remember in this evolution of science, scientific knowledge, is our recommendations affected people directly. It's not about giving them an option on should they eat eggs or not because of cholesterol. It is about don't go to school, don't send your children to school. Don't go to work, maintain physical distance, you know, wear a face mask all the time, you know, stop, you know, shelter in place in some cases. And that has, I think, you know, because of the disruption in people's lives, I think, you know, that has made it even more difficult. So this has been, you know, I often say this, this is not only a failure in our public health preparedness, this is also a kind of a failure in science communication. We have not been, we have somehow not been able to be ready to communicate science in such a difficult situation, especially when the science is evolving so fast. And of course, as the Surgeon General said, the velocity and the volume of spread of information has, you know, because of social media, has made it even tougher.
Let's bring on a caller now on our now functioning phone lines. Heidi is with us in La Crosse. Heidi, hello.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Yeah, I'm really concerned about, like, who is fact-checking the fact-checkers, because early on in this pandemic, I did a lot of research, and I found that all my sources were saying there was a very good chance that this came from the Wuhan lab. And when I posted that on Facebook, I was immediately censored. Yet now, that's coming out that is most likely the case. And there's also Dr. Astrid Stuckelberger. She's a whistleblower. She used to be on the ethics committee or board for the WHO, the World Health Organization. She's saying that the WHO is not even following their own policies. in what they're doing right now.
And Heidi, thanks for the call, and I'll fact check that. I mean, the vaccine lab leak is still an open question, but not, I don't think, seen as the most likely alternative here, Vish. But her main question, I think, is really interesting. How do we know we can trust the fact checking that we get, whether it's a social media platform or a media outlet or you name it?
It is absolutely an important question, I think. And my argument, my suggestion would be, you know, look at the credentials of the people. What is their level of expertise? Because at the end of the day, we want to go to experts, you know, who study this day in and day out. What is their financial interest and motivation in providing this information? What is their track record? What is the track record they have? And if you ask these questions, I'm not suggesting that you should believe everything that is out there, whatever the organization is, but look at the track record, look at their expertise, you know, look at their interests and motivations. And in general, you know, if you ask those questions, you know, we don't buy a car or anything without checking first, right? You know, it's the same thing with information. Do check them. Do look at these motivations, do look at interests and track record and expertise, and you should be able to arrive at some principles or rules of thumb in believing or not believing some information.
Heidi, thanks for that call. Vish, just in our last few minutes, Boris emailed to say, what are proven ways to talk to vaccination skeptics that can help convince facts appear not to work? Can you leave us in just our last half a minute with an idea of a convincing message?
Right. One thing you don't want to do is label people, you know. I never call them anti-vaxxers or all those labels. Those are not very helpful. I think we need to focus on people who are skeptical and try to understand where they are coming from. Most of it is not because of science, but because of what they have heard. They have, you know, some of them have been misled because through emotional stories. And I think we have to appreciate where they are coming from, where those fears are coming from, and work with those fears and addressing them and assuring them, and work with people they know and trust. That is the best way to do it. And there is a small group of people who can never be convinced, and that is the way it is. But a large number of people can be convinced, but work with them and converse with them, engage them, rather than scold them or label them.
And Vish, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Vish Viswanath is a professor of health communication at Harvard University's School of Public Health. Coming up after the news, Anne Lamott joins us to talk about how to stay hopeful and make it through the tough times in our lives. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 8 on The Morning Show, the plaintive call of the loon is a familiar sound on Wisconsin lakes. The author of the new book, Loon Lessons, shares the story of the water bird. That's tomorrow morning at 8 here on the Ideas Network. Now we're in the middle of something really difficult, whether it's life during a pandemic, a rough patch in a relationship, or the struggle with an addiction. It can be hard to keep up hope and remember that good moments are still possible. Anne Lamott has written a lot of books on how to find meaning and hope in hard times. In her new book, she says when times are tough, love can be the path to hope. Quoting here, hope springs from realizing we are loved, can love, and are loved with skin on. Anne Lamott is a novelist and nonfiction writer. She's also an activist, public speaker, and writing teacher. Her latest book is called Dusk, Night, Dawn, on Revival and Courage. I talked to Anne earlier this year. Here's our conversation. Well, this is a perfect book for this time. Did you know going into this book we were going to be dealing with this horrific pandemic that really had us thinking about hope and revival?
Well, I didn't know about COVID, but I was on book tour for the last book, whose subtitle was book Thoughts on Hope. I'd actually originally called it Doomed Thoughts on Hope, but my publisher wouldn't go for it. But so anyway, I was traveling around the country, and everywhere I went, people felt so defeated and really kind of freaked out and grief-struck about what was happening in our country. And, you know, then the fires in Australia, I mean, an entire continent was on fire. And then I live in California, and our state caught fire. apparently because we didn't rake the forest efficiently enough, and then we were told. And everywhere I went, people just said, where do we even start to get our mojo back? Where do we, what will our kids be wearing gas masks? This is also after the UN climate change reports that came out, and it was just all devastating. And so I sat down to try to answer that question of where do we start and what works and why bother?
Well, here's a quote talking about where we start. You write, we start in the here and now. And you talk about that in the scope of these huge global problems and in your own struggles in your daily life. It sounds maybe easier said than done. How do we look around us and start in the here and now to deal with something that seems overwhelming?
Well, you accept and understand that it's really hard. It's going to be hard to turn around climate change. It's hard to help a young person who's scaring you to death find their way back to a healthy path or whatever. But we're good at heart, and we're really good at heart. We've stopped fascism a couple times. We invented the antiretrovirals. We stopped smallpox. And so you start where you are. You think like for me, if I don't know what to do on any given day to get my confidence and hope back, I send money to a food pantry, or I drive to Safeway and I fill up two bags full of canned goods and powdered goods and candy, and I drive it over to the food bank in the Canal District here, which is where all the service workers for the county live, where the rate of COVID is astronomical. And you do that. You do anonymous things that help other people have hope, and then you've provided a little bit of hope for the day. You call your most annoying relative and you say, I was just thinking of you. How are you? You know, you take the action, in other words, and then the insight follows. The insight is that we, you know, Mother Teresa, may she rest in peace, said, no one can do great things, but everyone can do small things with great love. So you do a few things that are loving, you even do nice loving things for yourself, for cranky old crunchy neurotic judgmental you. You get yourself a lovely cup of tea, you take the dog for a 3-block walk, you get outside, you look up, you breathe, you wave to neighbors from across the street 6 feet away in masks, and you know, you do whatever you can to help wherever you can one day at a time.
And you talk about yourself as trying to live up to that ideal of giving to others, but also as the recipient. You have sometimes depended on the kindness of strangers, including a woman, I think, from Texas, who played a huge role in your path to sobriety. Can you talk about what one stranger did for you?
Yes. Well, this is 35 years ago almost when I got sober. But, you know, William Blake, the great poet, said, we're here to learn to endure the beams of love. And I just live by that because it's just so awful. And I'm so good at taking care of everyone else. I was raised to be a little flight attendant in my family. My parents had an unhappy marriage, and I had two brothers. And I had a little clipboard, I think, and a caseload of trying to give and save and rescue and fix them all. So to receive something like to receive so much love has taken a lot of practice. But I was in Florida. I was speaking at a national book event. I'd been sober about a year, so this would have been 1987. And I just lost it one night. I was really high up in a hotel. I was scared to death. I had a mini fridge filled with bottles of booze. And it was about midnight. And I was just so doomed. And I looked up a resource line for alcoholics, it was a 24-hour thing. And this guy, this young man, he's probably like 12, said, okay, Miss Lamont, we're going to send some over to talk to you. It was midnight. And I said, you're going to send someone over to talk to me? And they did, and they sent an elderly woman from Texas who arrived, as I discovered later, in a bright pink Cadillac. And she had the big hair, like Ann Richards always say, the higher the hair, the closer to God. And she came into this hotel room, and she stayed with me for like a couple hours, hour and a half. We shared stories. We shared our experience, strength, and hope. We made each other laugh about what crazy lushes we were. And I've always said laughter is carbonated holiness, you know. But Trevor Noah, who I love, said something better last week. He said, when you laugh with someone, you know you're really sharing something. And with the woman from Texas, I didn't know her from Adam's house cat. You know, we probably had nothing in common, not our politics, not our faith, not our anything. And we just sat and talked and laughed. And then she pulled down, you know, she got a bottle of water for me and put it by my bed and tucked, you know, pulled the sheets down and kind of commanded me to get into bed and try to rest. And I was fine.
We're talking to Anne Lamott about her new book, Dusk, Night, Dawn, on revival and courage. And you end the main body of the book with it's like a hymn to love and the power of love, I think. And one line, I'm going to spoil it. I hope that's okay with you, that really stuck out to me. Love reveals the beauty of sketchy people like us to ourselves. And there's a lot there about, I don't know, the grace we can offer ourselves for our failings and offer to others. Could you talk about that a little?
Yeah, it's my favorite topic, really, because we try to be people of love and forgiveness, but we've got to start with the most disappointing and annoying person we know, which is us. You know, otherwise we are just coming from a place of depletion and, you know, just clench and clutch. But if I can start off by doing something really well, let me say rather, I see intimacy as meaning into me I see. And it's past the surface, it's past the performance, it's past the performance art of having a public life, and it's into the parts of me that are deepest and most true. And I'm not hiding stuff that is adorable and beautiful and touching. You know, I'm suppressing stuff that's materialistic and petty and annoyed and judgmental. And so to go do the deep dive and to start to be forgiving towards myself, because I'm that way, I'm a very mixed grill of characteristics, then little by little I can start doing it with other people. I can start forgiving. I can start seeing beyond the enormous mistakes my parents made raising the three of us into how wounded and isolated and anxious they felt, how sad and how unloved they had really felt as children, and how, you know, they probably should have raised orchids or teacup poodles instead of children, but there we were. And I looked past everything they did that really hurt us to these really touching people who met and fell in love and did what they were told to do. They had children and they did the best they could, and it wasn't great. But, you know, the great theologian C.S. Lewis said something 50 or 60 years ago. He said, when you decide to become a person of forgiveness, maybe you don't stop with the Gestapo. You don't start with the Gestapo. You know, you start with your Aunt Blanche and the very odd things she says at every holiday table that are really hurtful. And you start with her and you realize how lonely she is and how she was raised this way. She's channeling her mother, you know, and you start to go a little bit easy on her. So that for me, love is it's both complex and simple, because people are tough, people are hard, people are damaged and ruined, and I am too, and I'm making a comeback, and other people are trying to too. And you know, some days go better than others. Some days are just too hard. Sometimes I have to call a best friend, this is always a solution, and say, I hate everyone in all of life. And then that friend will say, oh, I'm so glad you called, I do too. Let's go to Target, you know, and then you're back in the saddle.
We're listening back to my conversation with author Anne Lamott. She joined us earlier this year to talk about her latest book. It's called Dusk, Night, Dawn, on Revival and Courage. Coming up, we'll hear the rest of that conversation, including Anne's approach to what she calls the last third of life and how her perspective has changed over time. We'll hear more of that conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we're listening back to my conversation with writer Anne Lamott. She's known for writing openly about lots of big real-life issues like motherhood, alcoholism, and faith. She joined us in March to talk about her latest book. It's called Dusk, Night, Dawn, on Revival and Courage. Now we'll talk about how she's been approaching her later age and how we can use gratitude to cope when things get difficult. And you write about being in what you call the last third of your life. And things didn't magically improve in all ways. We're still people at that age. But you write that it gives you some perspective on the tough times and how long they're going to last. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, I actually wanted to call this book The Third Third because I'll be 67 next month. But, you know, what I experienced, I think at around 50, was that I noticed how much crud I was carrying around from place to place that I had been carrying around for 50 years. You know, like at 50, I called the public library in San Francisco and I said, send a van. And I gave them 300 books that I had been moving from place to place over the years. Most of them were from college that I attended briefly. And they were books that I kept on the shelf so that people would think I'm smarter and more educated and erudite than I am. And at 50, I thought, how much longer are you going to do this? Because all that stuff keeps us flying way too low. I mean, skimming the treetops. And I thought, I just really want to soar. And so I got rid of books. There were a few people I let go of gently because I had been agreeing to be with them for many years, although they were damaging to me or they made me feel shame or just small. And I very gently wiggled free, let's say, and maybe talked to them every few years instead of two or three times a year. I started to really prune and lighten the load, and that's made a huge difference in my life. But, you know, I have a great friend, Terry Ritchie, who's a Diocesan priest in Los Angeles, and he said something so brilliant. He said, we don't get over much here. And if I think about it, I'm very, very similar to the way I was at, like, 7, you know? I'm very sensitive. People get to me much, much less than they do because I just write them off. Or, you know, you just realize people get to think what they think and you're not going to change them. But we don't get over much here. So I do think I'm wiser. I do think my life makes a lot more sense because I say, you know why? Because I say no a lot more. And I think I was probably in my mid-50s when I discovered no was a complete sentence. And so that sort of frees me up to say yes with enthusiasm to the stuff that I really want to do or that I think may make a difference for a number of people. So does that answer your question?
Oh, it does. I think we've got our phone line sorted now. So let's try John in Mauston for real now. John, hi.
Hello.
Hi. What do you want to tell us about John?
Well, I was just saying that as a disabled Vietnam veteran from the 60s all the way to the 70s, the first thing I say when I come outside and sit in the sun is I say, thank you, Lord, for this day. Then I say a warrior's prayer to give hope to the POWs, closure to those loving families of MIAs, and protecting our troops both here and abroad, especially the first responders that are everywhere. Then I go on and I say a Hail Mary and ask her for intercession with the Lord Jesus Christ, my Savior, to watch over the women, all those abused, the sick, the lame. And I ended up, especially for the young girls, that are innocent women that are being trafficked by, I just call them evildoers. I'm not going to put a name on them because everybody knows who they are.
John, thanks a lot for calling in. And I hear there and gratitude, appreciation of nature, faith and compassion and concern for others. Sounds like a pretty good recipe.
Yeah, and it's also about waking up every morning instead of hitting the snooze button again and again and getting yourself outside and looking up and around you and letting yourself be blown away all over again. My old pastor used to have this great sermon based on how you can keep bees at the bottom of a mason jar with no lid on because they just walk around bumping into the glass kind of bitterly. I guess they have their arms crossed. And all they have to do is to look up, and then they can fly away. So when people call and they're depressed or lost, I just say, go outside, look up, look up, look up. And you don't look up and go, oh, it's a medium full moon tonight. You know, you look up and you go, oh, my God. And it spritzes you back awake. And so we do that over and over again all day if we remember to.
John, thanks for the call. We'll go to Tara now,
John,
in Lake Delta. And Tara, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to let you know a little coping mechanism I've learned over time. I suffer from depression myself, and I have liked watched lots of good movies with happy endings, and I write lots of cards to people to encourage them, especially during this pandemic time. But most of all, I wanted to let people know about this little thing I kind of fell upon, that I've been doing staycations at home, just going to other countries, studying about them, learning about the language, and watching like classic movies. Lately, I've been going to India, and I've been watching classic. Watching classic movies that have to do with India. You know, ones that are more low key movies. During this stressful time. I mean, my parents are elderly. They have difficulties right now, a very serious illness. And I'm just like, I throw my arms up in the air and I'm like, okay, I'm going to India.
Oh, I love that. That's a great idea.
I love it. Tara, thanks. Best to you and your folks. Anne, what do you think?
I think it's an amazing idea, but also I love that she writes cards to people to encourage them. And always, if you want to have loving feelings yourself, you do loving things for other people. You know, you call your lonely and very annoying uncle, and you just check in with him. And, I mean, to write cards to people is just so wonderful, because then they can hold on to it, and especially if it has a really pretty picture on it. But it was nice talking to her.
Tara, thanks. And our last minute, Anne, you know, we've had this pandemic for a year plus now. I've heard from callers. They're feeling, you know, there's light at the end of the tunnel, but they're feeling really drained and down right now. Thoughts for them in our last minute on how to keep it up for another little longer.
Well, it's hard, and I think you have to give yourself credit for what we've done together, what we've come through, and just like pat yourself nicely on the shoulder like you would anybody else. And we're good at hard, and we just keep taking – for me, I just keep trying to help the poor. I keep it very simple. I really love the food pantries and those pictures of the mile-long lines to get a box of food for your family are heartbreaking. And so I send everyone I hear about some money, and I go over to the one in San Rafael, and I just keep it really simple. I really don't think that figure it out is a very good slogan for life. And so I just take the action, and then the insight follows, which is that, I just try to keep the patient comfortable. We've come through a lot. There's been a really deep, deep sense of gratitude for the people of service. You know, Mr. Rogers' mother always said that great thing to him when there was a tragedy or a crisis. She said, look to the helpers. And so I make myself be aware all the time of these incredible first responders, EMTs, and the nurses. Oh, my God. And that just fills me with humility and gratitude, and just kind of can help me hit the reset button, that this has been so hard, and it's been astonishing.
Anne, thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having me. I love this.
That was Anne Lamott, novelist and nonfiction writer. I talked with her earlier this year about her book, Dusk, Night, Dawn, on Revival and Courage. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, COVID relief funding is coming to communities around the state. We'll find out what that could mean for Wisconsin's biggest city with Milwaukee Mayor Tom Barrett. The last year has brought challenges for mental health at the workplace. We'll get advice on the best ways to help yourself, your coworkers, or your employees. And the average adult keeps two embarrassing secrets from their friends, according to a recent study. A psychologist joins us for a look at secrets. That's tomorrow at Central Time. On last week's edition of Food Friday, we got some great advice on making burgers, meat, and veggie varieties. You can still find a couple of recipes, one each, actually, at WPR.org/Food Friday. And we asked you to tell us about your favorite burger in Wisconsin, and you did, over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. You can still keep sending yours there, by the way. We heard from James, who says, Mickey Lou's in Marinette. There ended your search for the best burger in Wisconsin. Well, there you have it. But wait, Joan says the Branding Iron Roadhouse in Lime Ridge can't beat it. Well, I don't know who to believe now. Cassandra recommends the bar in my home, Chef My Husband. All right, Cassandra, waiting for that invite. I would love to put it to the test. Jocelyn suggests Cops in Milwaukee, a big name there. Jocelyn says cheeseburger with the works. My only complaint is if you get the burger and fries, there's no room for custard left. At least usually. Ted says, been enjoying Veggie Burger's Simple Truth Organic brand from Pick and Save. Brenda goes with the Impossible Burger at Monk's in Eau Claire. Brenda says definitely worth the drive from Barron. And Joe likes Bison Burgers. Joe says, I found the Beyond Meat Burgers flavors are too strong. I hope they fix that. Well, again, get a couple great burger recipes at WPR.org/Food Friday. Keep sharing your favorite burger options in Wisconsin on the Ideas Network Facebook page. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.